This is a special Memorial Day edition of Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. It's estimated that at least 40 million people are living with HIV/AIDS around the world. Of them, over 28 million are Africans. Last year alone, there were an estimated 3.4 million new HIV infections in sub-Saharan Africa. Over 55% of these were women. Correspondent Rupert Cook is one of the only Western journalists to travel throughout Africa talking to HIV-positive women. Here are their voices.
My name is Beatrice Were. I'm from Uganda, and I work as a social worker back home in a hospital. I discovered that I was infected with HIV in 1991 when I lost a partner, and I decided to test. At that time, I was in my early 20s. I'd just finished my first degree at the university.
My name is Eunice Atino Dongo. I come from Kenya in the Eastern Africa, and I'm living with HIV/AIDS virus. I've been living with HIV virus that causes AIDS for a period of now 6 years' time. I was tested, I was diagnosed in 1996, December, and I was traumatized when I knew my status. And I went further to test my children. They are both negative. So I'm living with them, I'm separated. I'm a single parent. If I can remember how I got HIV virus, was I was pregnant, and after giving birth, I had a herpes zoster on my face, and I further went for my baby passed away. So after burial, I came back home and decided to go for the HIV test, and I found I was HIV positive. So I cannot really blame where I got the virus from, because the baby died at 3 months old, and in the panel of giving birth, we were three women at a go, and I cannot tell whether I got it from my husband or from the hospital. I can't blame anyone, but I'm HIV positive.
My name is Alice Kakengi Mustafa. I am coming from Tanzania and senior agriculture field officer. That is my profession. I am living with HIV now. It is 11 years. I discovered after my husband first was sick. Then after she was with TB, he was with TB. After that issue, we decided to go for HIV test. We are tested and we are HIV positive. My husband died after 5 years. And I lost my child, my one of my son, because of HIV. That is how I discovered that I am HIV positive.
I'm Brigitte Siamalevu from Zambia. I discovered that I was HIV positive in 1992. I was not feeling sick or anything, but I decided on my own to go for counseling and testing. What prompted me to go was because I saw the anguish, the grief, and the pains of the girls. At that moment, I was actually a secondary school teacher in a mission school, and I was in charge of guidance and counseling for the girls. And many of them were coming with funeral issues, losing a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, and the pain and the anguish that I experienced with those children made me decide to go and find out about my status so that I start preparing my own children for my eventual death.
My name is Chipomba Nje, and I come from Zimbabwe. I discovered in September 1992, but truthfully speaking, it took me another year for me to really believe that I was indeed positive, because when I took the test, somehow I thought, this doctor, how can you be asking for a test? Obviously, I'm negative. And when the test came positive, I just told the doctor, no, you have to take another test because this is wrong. I can't be positive. And it took me 3 tests within a year for me to end up really believing. And my first reaction was I cried for a long time. And at that time, I was not well. And the doctor actually said, you don't have much long to live. week or 3 weeks, and I literally waited for death.
I was overwhelmed by the situation. I was traumatized. I felt cheated at one point, and I could not really tell what could have come before me. So I felt I was going to die soon, and I really it took me time, almost 6 months, to know real that I am HIV positive.
I was hoping against hope that I would be negative, even when I had made up my mind and said I was going to go and get tested. When I found out, when I was told the results, I actually went numb. And I remember I went with my youngest child, and I just held him very, very tight. And my only wish was, I wish I could be there when you're at least in grade one. My child was about 1.5 years old. So I just said, I wish I could be there in your life to give you guidance. It was sort of a sense of hopelessness and helplessness.
I feel very, very sad because I was knowing that wherever you have HIV, you are going to die recently. So I was thinking that any time I can die. So I was feeling very sad at that time. But I didn't know that we can live longer with this virus. I didn't know first. I come to know after some counseling, some education I get, some information. The first time I was very sad that I am going to die.
You know, I just felt my hopes shattered. I was shocked. I was frustrated. I felt disappointed, and I lost hope, and I also felt a great sense of loss of direction. You know, I felt so bad, and I thought I would die before, you know, realizing my ambition, my hopes for the future.
Yeah, I had to deal with my serostatus first with my own self, how to accept it. It took me about 6 to 9 months to sort of look at, you know, I got angry that I had allowed myself to get infected, and I was pained. I was looking around for support, and the most probable people where I went and told them that I was positive could not give me that support because they started feeling sorry for me. I didn't want any sympathy. I just wanted someone to listen so that I talk out the pains that I was going through. And after about 6 to 9 months during that period, I resolved that angry, yes, I was, but that I should turn my anger into positive action.
My attitude started changing. I should say in 1993, the biggest impact was when I met the bigger group of women living with HIV, and these were active women sharing the same issues that I went through, the isolation and the fears around death and, you know, the losses they had gone through. And I saw these women smiling, and, you know, the power of being together as women made me realize that there was hope after all. And it also made me realize that I was not alone. And from that day, I've never been the same person. From immediately after that, I actually became open about my status. And I was telling everybody about the wonderful group of women that I met. And I began to challenge many people who felt, you know, who were preaching to people with HIV, so many do's and don'ts back home. And I told them, this is what I saw women from other parts of the world doing, and they are living a happy life. And I'm not accepting anybody to dictate to me how I must live my life, what I must do with my life, and, you know, when I should do it and where to do it.
My husband in the beginning did not want to hear of it because he had actually told me not to go for testing. After some time, when he accepted that I had gone and I was HIV positive, he started giving me all the support, you know, health-wise, encouraging me to rest because I'm some kind of a workaholic. And we talked with our adolescent children. Some of them did not want to hear of it. The others thought they could support us. You know, there was a reversal kind of role for some children trying, you know, started becoming my mother. And the school where I was working, of course, it was a mission school. The sisters don't discuss these issues. They were so pitiful to me. And, you know, it's such a pity that you are sick. But I didn't find that a very good environment for my growth because I would tend to, you know, to pity myself. So I moved from that program to another program where I was in charge of developing materials for HIV/AIDS and doing outreach for women living with HIV/AIDS.
I told my parents, I told everybody, because I thought, oh, anyway, after all, I'm going to die, so let everybody know. Not knowing that, you know, being HIV positive myself and disclosing that, I didn't know, because at that time there was not really enough information that I needed to also prepare my own parents. But with me, I didn't prepare my relatives with that. It was just like, boom, there it is. And it's only, I think, after 5 years that I was realizing, you know, what were they going through? It is the same thing that I went, the same mental terrorism I went through when I got my results, that everybody that you disclose to is going to go through.
I remember my father was so confused, very shocked. Being his first child, it was something he didn't want to hear. I was his first child who had a university degree, and that meant a lot to him. He had invested so much in my education. It's very expensive to invest in educating children, in more so girls, because very few people valued that. I remember when I just finished my primary 7, one man told my father, I think that's enough for that girl. It doesn't make sense to invest so much in a girl, because she's going to marry someone else anyway, and that person will, you know, it's somebody else who will enjoy the prestige. So I could see my father feeling so depressed. I know that my siblings, my young brothers and sisters, were very upset because I'm their eldest sister, whom they looked so much unto as a role model. But for my children, personally, for the biggest, what overwhelmed me most was with my children, because I took some time to tell them. And I personally feel very guilty that I went open about my status before letting them know. And I know that really worked them up, particularly my eldest daughter. And I remember her accusing me of being unfair to her, going out and letting the press know before telling her. And I apologized and I tried to mend the broken pieces, and I made them understand why I went public. And from that time, I told them I would listen to them and understand how they felt. And since that time, it has become easy for me to speak, because I don't have any guilt anymore.
I would say the media has managed to portray being HIV positive negatively because of the doom, the messages of doom that they give. If you are positive, your future is not, you don't have a future, your life is destroyed, and so on. But I find that's the reason why many educated women, many women don't really come out publicly to talk about their status, because we don't have programs that are in workplaces that will support, you know, environments that will be supportive to your coming out with your zero status. And we still have, in many quarters, a lot of denial, and some of them are attributing being HIV positive to promiscuous life or to, you know, to witchcraft. Your security is at risk if you divulge your zero positiveness. But for me, I went out as an activist. I knew I didn't have anything to fear, and I had stuck my neck out because I want to make sure that women have information to empower them to be in charge of their lives.
Many people, they don't want to be open, especially those who are professionals. Those who are open are those who are juniors, I think. They are poor. But those who are rich, they don't want to say that they got HIV. So the stigma is still there at my country. I think to reduce the stigma, it is the people to understand, or to have education, how to go about the, how HIV is, how people like us, like me, myself, I am open. If somebody looks at me as I am 10 years now with the virus, I am okay, I am working, I am happy, I am wealthy. And another thing, it is, of course, the education. If you get education, real education, that HIV is like other disease, like diabetes, whatever, I think you can't feel with the stigma to say that I've got HIV AIDS.
Because of the way HIV came, and up to now, in Zimbabwe, I think even in many other African countries, STDs and HIV is a woman's disease. you go to a health center and the men will tell you if they got gonorrhea, they have a woman's disease. So if you're HIV positive, it's a woman's disease who is bringing it into the home. So you're stigmatized in terms of culturally you're supposed to be quiet and not talk about this. And you're sort of bringing this death within a home when you're supposed to be a proper woman is supposed to be sort of, in a way, I always say like, it's like a folded blanket in the corner of a house. That's how you're supposed to behave, you see. So women actually are even chased away from their own marital homes. What really also hurts me most is that if you are married and you develop AIDS and you are very ill, when you need the most support, it is then that the husband will actually tell you to go and get that care from your own parents. But if the husband or the man gets ill, it's you supposed to take care of them. And that phenomenon, I think we need to really address it and find ways of saying we need to support one another within this home.
Many people still believe that when a person is diagnosed with HIV, they are not expected to express their desires around sex particularly. It is one way that I personally feel that there is injustice and denial of human rights of people living with HIV. For me as a woman, I know that in the community where I come from, when a woman with HIV even mentions that they, you know, I would like to have a baby, people would look at you like you're not serious. After all, you're likely to bring to have a baby that will have HIV anyway and die. You're going to bring a burden to us. It's that kind of impression. I also know that when I decided to get into a relationship, after some time when I felt I'm still a young woman, I can't continue living a lonely life, and I got into a relationship, it was a major issue, and people felt, as a role model, why should she, you know, move around with a man, have sex? She's being careless. She's, you know, she's teaching others bad manners. She's spoiling other women, and people really rejected me and looked at me like, you know, like I'm crazy. I think what should be a concern here is to understand that we are having protected sex, and to support us to make these decisions and to communicate very well to the people that we are having sex with and make sure that we don't give them HIV or they don't reinfect us. I think that it's more important to think about that. It is also important to understand that the majority of women who are getting infected in Africa are young women in their early 20s, some of them even below 20 years of age, and this is the age where we are sexually active, where we have sexual desires, and we must be given room to express how we feel.
I am a true living experience of someone who thought when I was given my results that my life was over. But from 1992, I have achieved things that I never thought. I fight for my living and my rights. And the best thing of it all is that my relationship with my husband has sort of bloomed to a relationship of partnership where I have no fear to say what I feel about issues, and he also says what he feels about issues. Now we have even, you know, touching, hugging, and we talk plain, you know, openly about issues. I think my life after HIV diagnosis has been more fruitful than before, because I lived with fears. I wanted to please everybody. I wanted to be everything to everybody. I think I've been more empowered since I knew my status and moved in with other women to talk about issues that pertain to women and HIV/AIDS.
There are many times where I've actually regretted that I've even known that I'm positive. It is because I'm positive, people think I can't even have sex. If they didn't know I'm positive, or if I didn't know, I wouldn't even give a damn about it. I would just go ahead and enjoy myself, if that's what enjoyment is all about. And at the moment, I think in Zimbabwe and in many other African countries, there's everything to lose by knowing and declaring that you're HIV positive than anything to gain. Because the whole world looks at you. And I remember when I went public at first, actually people were saying, oh, it's because she's single. She must be very desperate. She must be very frustrated. You see, and wherever you go, people will be pointing fingers at you. You go into the office and everybody's like walking away and all that. So there's everything to lose and anything to gain by actually even going for a test. And the unfortunate thing is that we don't have support systems in place, especially at community level. We are saying there are counseling services in the urban areas, but most people who are positive, and especially the women, are in the rural areas. They can't access information about preventing of STIs or whatever. They can't access information about even boosting their own immunity system in terms of treatment. They can't even access information about even preventing the mother-to-child transmission. They can't even access anything, any kind of support system. So that's why people say, why should I know what's there for me if I know? After all, when I know, the doctor will tell me that I'm going to die. So why should I know? I might as well not know.
Even the essential drugs that we need for opportunistic infections, we don't get them. For me, I'm a teacher. I'm a middle-class kind of a person. But for the women and the children that are dying in the communities, and you notice that in Africa, it's actually the poorest of the poor that are really affected, which means they don't even know how to say what they need, and they have no voice out there.
The antiretrovirals, they are available in Zimbabwe, but they are not accessible in terms of the cost. I've got a stable job, but I definitely cannot even afford one of those, even monotherapy. I can't afford it. And what surprises me is that why should they be so expensive? I asked one guy from Galaxo Welcome in Geneva, and he told me that it was the marketing. And I was saying, hello, marketing? How can it be so expensive when you've got such a demand? It doesn't make sense to me, because it's not a matter of advertising. How can you be advertising that? You should actually be complaining to say the demand is too much. But if they say it's the marketing that really costs, it's I think it's genocide, because I think we need these drugs. And unfortunately, for us in Africa, especially maybe in Zimbabwe, is that we need the whole package, not just the drugs. Because there's no way I can be taking those drugs on an empty stomach. Many people at the moment are not dying from the infection. They are not dying from AIDS or HIV. They are dying from malnutrition. That's what's killing people. And we are saying treatment, even the whatever, whether it's treatment for opportunistic infections, which are killing people even more, it's not just taking that cotrimoxazole on an empty stomach. There are issues of poverty which should actually be addressed as a whole component to say, the drugs, yes, but I need food, I need clean water. So the most important thing, I think, maybe especially for Zimbabwe, is first of all addressing our own health system, because I cannot even access a Panadol, a painkiller, let alone an antibiotic. So how can we even start talking about antiretrovirals? We understand and we appreciate that they are very useful. But if you look at our own context, it's like dreaming. It's like to me, talking about antiretrovirals to a common person in Zimbabwe is an insult, because what is the issue there is a bread and butter issue. It's having food. Just one meal per day is what is more important. So when we talk about even this issue of having free nivirapine, if I'm hungry, it won't even help me, because I'll have a malnourished child at the end of the day.
In communities, there are two classes. There are those that are positive and those that are negative. If I'm infected, you must be affected. I'm going to die in the community, it's going to affect you, because maybe I was a teacher, maybe I was your auntie, I was your sister, I was your cousin, I was your workmate. So we have got to support one another and make sure that we remain uninfected. Those of us that are infected, make sure that we keep the infection to ourselves so that we don't destroy the whole community.
My message to the women is that living positively can sustain our lives. By living positively, I mean we really need to know, have our daily logbook of what we eat. When I eat this, what affect me? If I don't eat this, do I get well? Do I get sick? So you have to monitor what you are eating. You have to monitor your kind of movement in terms of sexual behavior. Are you using protective sex? Because we have to live a full life at one point or the other. We have families to take care of. So you really have to monitor your way of nutrition, your way of sexual life, and the coping mechanisms in terms of treatments. Do you go for often treatments when you are sick? And if you're going for treatments, you really have to be clear to the doctor, I am HIV positive. So I need this, I use this medicine when I'm sick, or I use this medicine. So you just don't go to the doctor and the doctor prescribes you take this. Maybe there are side effects, maybe there are allergies that you might get in results of bad use of medicines. So you really have to get close to monitor what affects you at what time, how often do you get opportunistic infections. So we have to monitor a lot of things in our bodies and our systems of life.
What I would like to say is that all the women out there, there's nobody who is going to come from next door to come and help you, to come and really maybe rescue you out of your misery. It starts from within. And it starts from within, and then you actually disclose, you actually start talking about it, and then you go out there and actually look for the information, look for support yourself. Nobody's going to bring support in on a silver plate. We need to actually be strong, we need to be brave to actually go out there and demand for actually support systems to be created. Nobody will actually come and kneel in front of us and give us that help. We need to start from within and go out there to demand what needs to be put in place for us.
That report was prepared by Rupert Cook for this Memorial Day edition of Free Speech Radio News. Tomorrow, Free Speech Radio News will return to regular programming. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
I'm Martha Baskin in Seattle. I report for Free Speech Radio News because it dares to tell the stories ignored by the mainstream media. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a tax-deductible donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.